Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about education, education, education. CEOs coming to save the nation. Obama meeting with some big wigs today. How do we fix the big cliff? How do we soften the cliff? How do we do it? How? Oh, how? Because there's only 34 days. 34 days until the end of the world as we know it, the fiscal cliff. Oh, it's coming. Only 34 days. Yeah, the end of the world. So we've been told again and again and again. How many people are tired of hearing that, well, we got to come to a deal by the end of the year? I mean, are we that easily divided? I mean, come on. Also going to be talking about the filibuster. There's the talk again about fixing the filibuster, and my answer on it has been very simple. I'm not against the filibuster as long as you're willing to stand there and hold the floor for as long as you can. This way, the person who is filibustering, we know. So when the Employee Free Choice Act, for instance, comes up, I want to hear the right wing come out and spew their nonsense so that working people in this country can actually hear what they truly believe. And I don't want the filibuster, they have to stay on topic. None of this, oh, we're going to read Moby Dick, or oh, we're going to read War and Peace, or we're just going to read the newspaper. No, no. You've actually got to debate. You've got to hold the floor, and you have got to stay on topic. Is that too difficult? And then when you're done, when you've finished, when you've exhausted your argument, then you have a vote. Or you just keep talking and keep going and keep going and keep going until, well, you and I get tired of it. I think it's that simple. But also going to talk about the grand fiscal mirage. You're starting to see a couple of Republicans. This Tom Cole has been, you know, I guess thrown out there to say that he believes that Republicans should join hands with Obama, you know, because it would strengthen their position to join hands with Obama and give most taxpayers what he said was an early Christmas present. And I don't quite know that it would be a Christmas present, but you know what? Keep the Bush handouts for the bottom 98% of people, you know, just for now, until the economy turns around, until it gets stronger. And then maybe look at raising them down the road. But let the top 2%, let those expire. And we've seen Grover Norquist running around. Probably the one guy in Washington who really is a little worried. Because his power and influence is waning. And there are a lot of people who are trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to keep the grand pledge? But still do what's responsible. And where Norquist gained a lot of his power is he can use George H.W. Bush as the poster child for what happens if you go against the pledge. Because if you remember, you go back to 1992, you know, he had said, you know, in 88, read my lips, no new taxes, nothing, not going to happen, not raising taxes. Well, he ended up having to, because when he got the books, when he finally found out what the Reagan years had done, the direction the country was going, the massive deficits that we were running, the massive debt that we were accumulating, he said, wait a second, we've got to do something to stop this and stop it now. We've got to stop raiding the Social Security Trust Fund. We've got to stop borrowing money that we don't have, and we're going to raise taxes on the wealthy. And he raised taxes on everybody, to be honest. And Clinton beat him up for it. And he ended up losing. So Norquist has held that over the Republicans for years. Saying, see, you raise taxes, even if it's for the right reasons. Even if it's to save the nation, we're going to hold you responsible. So he came out today with another grand plan. Because understand, the Republicans truly believe in scorched earth. This is a two-year-old party. They're a party full of petulant two-year-olds kicking and screaming, and I want my way. Mine, 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 mine. So what he said, he was being interviewed, Grover, and he said, look, Republicans have other leverage. Continuing resolutions on spending, on debt ceiling increases, that's one thing that he pointed out. He said that the Republicans could give Obama debt ceiling increases once a month. Because the big debt ceiling crisis, you know, that's coming up too. That's part of all of this mess. And he said, you know, they can have Obama on a short leash. You know, here's your allowance. Come back next week or come back next month. And if he's not good, then they'll do it weekly. And I started thinking about this. Because you look at what the last debt debacle did to our nation and how much more it has cost us. By having that hostage debt crisis situation, and you have the credit rating bureaus lowering our credit rating, even just a small amount as they did, it upped the interest that we pay on the debt, still a very small amount, but still more than it had to. So we ended up paying out more than we should have had we had a functional Congress. But for Republicans, it was a win because they were able to make the black guy in the White House look bad. Didn't matter what it did to the country. Didn't matter one bit. What it was about was scoring political points. Now, the last time, the last debacle, that one situation, think about this, that one debacle cost us almost $19 billion. Now, think about that, doing it every month, doing that every week. But again, it isn't about good governance. It isn't about doing what's best for the country. It's about them keeping their pledge. It's about them keeping the tax cuts for the very, very wealthy, the ones who fund people like Norquist. And the thing that gets me is the Republicans want to extend those tax breaks to the 98%. But they know that that's their bargaining chip to get it for the top 2%. And that is who they're truly fighting for. And they use all of this language, oh, it's a crisis, oh, you know, it's the cliff. You know who it's a cliff for? You know who it's a true fiscal cliff for? People who are on unemployment. The people who are going to get kicked off the extended unemployment benefits. They're saying somewhere, what, one, two million people? And you look at this coming year, if we allow the unemployment extension to expire, it's going to cost us about 300,000 jobs. We could use those. And you go, well, how's that possible? How's it possible that we're going to create 300,000 jobs? Well, that money that you paid out in unemployment benefits, that goes into the economy. It's spent immediately. And that demand, you know, stuff that creates jobs, will do just that. And I know the right loves to point their finger and say, oh, Obama's the food stamp president, the unemployment president, and all that. Remember what he took over. Remember the crisis this nation was in and still is. And we have a real jobs crisis going on. You want to talk about a real crisis? Getting people back to work, that's the real jobs crisis. And unemployment insurance kept a couple million people out of poverty. But that's something that the right doesn't want to talk about. And last night we talked with Lou Prince, the owner of Vintage Vinyl, one of the largest independently owned record store in the Midwest here. And, you know, some of the things that he got to talk to the president about yesterday, and some of the things that small businesses like him want to see, like a raise in the minimum wage, like more money in folks' pocket, extending the top 2% tax rate. And what he said was, and he's spot on, that you know, this argument that the Republicans keep making about, well, you know, if you raise all, you raise the taxes on those top 2%, those are small business owners. Like Lou pointed out, only 3% of small business owners would be affected. 3%. Now, I heard Boehner today say, well, more than 50%. And I got to be honest, I know very few small business owners who pocket $200,000 or $250,000 in a year. I know some that have revenues in the millions. I know very few that put in their pocket $250,000. And if they do, I do believe, you know, we should be asking a little bit more of them. So today the president met with some big CEOs. Yesterday he met with the small business people. Today he met with the big CEOs, people like Lloyd Blankenfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, the guy who's at a Home Depot, a guy has had a Coke, you know, these Caterpillar, Pfizer, Comcast, these big multinationals. Do you think any of them said, you know what would help the country, Mr. President, if you raise the minimum wage? I don't think you would hear one of those CEOs say, you know what would help the country, Mr. President, if you gave workers the right to organize and you got more money into people's pockets. You want to know how to get this economy going? Go back to yesterday's program. Go to the RickSmithShow.com, download yesterday's podcast, and listen to what Lou Prince said. That's how we get this economy going. Money in people's pockets, better wages, better conditions for them to work under. And, oh, by the way, maybe trade policies that would benefit this country first. And this whole fiscal mirage, this whole showdown, the gunfight at the OK Corral, this is not a cliff. This is not a crisis. This is extortion. This is them trying to rip us off. And we need to say no. We need to stand up and say, you know what? This is not a crisis that we cannot solve. This was a crisis that you created and one we can easily fix. And we're not going to cut Medicaid. We're not going to cut Medicare. We're not going to gut Social Security. That isn't even something we're going to talk about at this point. And I think, and I know the president's going to be going around the country soon, bringing it to folks saying, look, these are our choices. And I think he's got the people on his side. Poll after poll says, you know what? Raise taxes on the very wealthy so we can educate our kids. We can build our roads and bridges. We can invest in the future and still pay our debt and pay off our deficits. There's a smart way of doing this. And then there's the extortion way of doing it. And I'm telling you, I'm hoping the Democrats grow a spine on this. Because this is another one of those situations where we can only lose. We need to raise taxes on the very wealthy. It's just what it is. And these big corporations. And we need to protect Social Security and Medicare. Simple. And we need to invest in the future. It's that simple. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 600 workers at 5 nursing home facilities in Connecticut who have been on strike more than 5 months have been reinstated by a federal judge in Hartford. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Okay, so we're going to have people from the other picket lines come in here throughout the day, okay? We're having a lot of politicians, a lot of community people tonight, okay? This is a time to show this company that we won, all right?
That was Jesse Martin, an organizer with the New England Healthcare Employees Union, District 1199, speaking to workers at Healthbridge's West River Nursing Home in Milford last Thursday morning. The company had locked out the workers at that site exactly 1 year before, and a planned candlelight vigil to mark the anniversary turned into a celebration instead. After 113 days, a judge ordered the company to end the lockout, and 2 months later, in mid-June, Healthbridge imposed its own contract. The company offer froze pensions and raised workers' health insurance premiums by at least $6,000 more per year for family coverage. It also took back 6 paid sick days and a week's vacation for many employees. So workers at all 5 facilities walked out. On December 12th, federal judge Robert Schettini ruled that the company had refused to bargain in good faith and had imposed the cuts unilaterally. He ordered all the workers reinstated by Monday, December 17th. Noreen Gates, a 20-year employee who's the central supply coordinator, said the company underestimated the workers' determination.
When they locked us out last December, I think that they felt that they locked just West River out and not the others because they felt that we were the weakest link in the union. And it's kind of backfired in a way because this line is stronger than ever now.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Milford, Connecticut.
Clear Channel is turning off the broadcasting antenna at WDTW in Detroit, taking the Progressive Talk AM station dark at the end of December. This follows the end of Progressive Talk at KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, and at KFNQ in Seattle. Tony Truppiano hosts the daily First Shift pro-labor talk show on WDTW in Detroit. He knew by the passage of the anti-union so-called right-to-work legislation in Michigan that it would be harder to continue to rely on labor union sponsors to keep his show thriving. Truppiano is devastated by the decision, but told his listeners he hopes that they carry on their struggle for economic and social justice for working people.
I am heartbroken. I am devastated. I can't thank you enough for everything you have done to fight for the good people of the state of Michigan and in our communities. It is critical to me that no matter if I'm on the air or not, whether I'm leading you or not, that you continue to fight this fight that is so critical to restore some sanity as we move forward.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax cuts?
Well, usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension
crisis.
Right,
but you've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced 2 previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
Ah, yes, the governor has had success in closing the budget holes. Yes, he has. And who has he done it off the backs of? Oh, yeah, the most vulnerable. You look at this latest round of slash-and-burn policy, doing away with the general assistance budget, 70,000 of the state's most vulnerable, cut off at the knees without even telling them. And you go back and you look at the last 2 budgets, $1 billion a year from education, cuts to social services. Yeah, that's success. In a conservative world, yeah, that is success. And you look at the latest success. You know, for a while I've been screaming about how these charter schools have been getting preferential treatment, how the charter schools are being pushed down our throat by this administration, and how they wanted to change how you evaluate these charter schools, because you know what? They can't stand up to the same scrutiny that our public schools are put under, so we've got to change that, right? So that, yeah, well, you know, be a little more lenient. Oh, they're just growing. According to the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education says, no, I don't think so, which, again, is why if you remember the Republican primary, they wanted to do away with the Department of Education. Heaven forbid we have someone who actually paying attention. Well, here to talk about that, I've got our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, good to be here, Rick. How are you?
I am good. So I'm looking at this, you know, this smackdown, I guess, is the best word I can use. The U.S. Department of Education says, no, you can't judge them differently.
Well, that's absolutely right, and it was what we were saying all along, but what's most shocking is that what we have here is a system, a rigged system, aimed at having the taxpayers of this state finance a substandard system of education, you know, that most important of things that a government does, education for our children, set up by two sets of rules. So intentionally making school district run schools look bad and intentionally making substandard charter schools look good. This is not merely sleight of hand. This is what was found by the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Education to not be permissible because it violated federal law, violated federal regulations. And this was done by State Education Secretary Ron Tamales and Governor Tom Corbett. Not anybody, but two exceptionally high-ranking government officials. Two officials who, upon taking office, both took the same oath and raised their right hands and each swore to uphold, protect, and defend the laws of the United States and the laws of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And they broke those laws. Now, when any of the people listening to this show break the law, they pay a price.
Yep.
They pay a fine. They go to jail. They lose their license. But when a high-ranking government official who didn't just break the law, but broke the law after taking an oath to uphold and protect that law, are found to have broken the law and rigged the system, lied to the people who are financing the system, the taxpayers, about what they were doing to their children, they say, gee whiz, and they conduct hearings to charter more cyber charter schools, which are totally unregulated.
Yeah. And failing horribly. I mean, if you read the Stanford study, the cyber charter schools just absolutely, I think there's one in the state that's even close to making AYP.
Yeah, well, we've got to explain what AYP is. AYP is the shorthand for average yearly progress. And under the federal No Child Left Behind law, you know, the one adopted by the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, schools are to be evaluated based upon the progress that the children in those schools made and make. And there's a measure of average yearly progress. So school districts are evaluated on a district-by-district basis, and schools are evaluated on a school-by-school basis. The Corbett administration decided unilaterally, and now in what has been found to be a direct violation of federal law, to treat every individual charter school as if it is an entire school district, and thereby get relaxed standards. So of 77 charter schools out of about 110 charter schools total in Pennsylvania that were claimed to have made average yearly progress minimum standards, under the Corbett and Tamales imposed fake and phony rules, 44 actually didn't make average yearly progress. Under the Bush No Child Left Behind law. So that's like two-thirds of the ones in the rigged system didn't make it.
Right.
But it gets worse because there are 12 cyber charter schools in Pennsylvania. You know what they are. Those are the online schools, no bricks, no mortar. But the taxpayers still have to pay those schools that have no bricks, no mortar, no building, no heat, no light, no air conditioning, no walks to shovel in the winter, no grass to cut in the summer.
Craigslist teachers, sure.
You know, and who knows what kind of teachers, and all done online. Of the 12 cyber charter schools, do you know how many made average yearly progress? Counting all of them?
One.
One. And that was by being measured by the phony standards.
So then would it be safe to say none did?
Well, I can't tell you yet. I don't know. We're combing through that information. Actually, not more than a half an hour ago, I was meeting with some of the officials of the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers in Pennsylvania, and we've begun looking at just that question to make a determination. This is a fraud on the taxpayers perpetrated by high public officials who were sworn to uphold the law that they broke.
So let me
every day in my practice, I represent people who are claimed to have broken laws, and they suffer consequences. In this instance, when these public officials broke the law, our children suffered. The taxpayers suffered. There needs to be an answer for this. There needs to be a public repudiation of this. Maybe somebody needs to be going to jail for this.
I'm with you. But, you know, here's the thing that gets me. You know, are there any credible studies out there at all that show that these cyber charter schools have any value whatsoever?
The only credible studies, and you mentioned the one that's most credible, the Stanford study, shows exactly the opposite. It shows that these cyber charter schools are a sham. We know empirically that they must be because of all of the little pieces of evidence. We had the story, and we talked about it on your show a few months ago, the Frontier Cyber Charter School, where the school in August terminated all of its teachers. And it was supposed to have 200 students. It ended up with like 25. And of the 25, only a handful actually got the computers that were necessary to access the school. And they made a unilateral determination to measure truancy not on the basis of kids participating in the program, but by the number of days in between logons to the computer. And this cyber charter school that has no bricks, has no mortar, has no any place other than a little office, when we called there last April to find out some information, the clerical worker who answered the phone when we asked to talk to the people who were running the school said, oh, they're not here. It's Easter vacation. Yet children were expected to log on if they could get access to a computer somehow. And that little enterprise ended up costing the school districts that were called upon to support it, the taxpayer-funded public school districts that were compelled to support it, nearly $400,000+.
Wow.
Before it was shut down, and we don't know what happened to the money, and we don't know what happened to the kids.
Well, we know that the kids who signed up for it were the ones end up holding the bag. But what bothers me in all this is you look at all of this money that we're spending on these cyber charter schools, and I find nothing that tells me it's doing any good. But at the same time, we're cutting budgets, we're cutting education dollars, and we're splitting and dividing the pie. That is a recipe for disaster.
Of course it's a recipe for disaster. What is the most basic lesson of economics? We invest in the future. We invest in our children. And here what we're saying is that our children aren't worth it. They're not even worth a proper monitoring of what they're being exposed to. They can only be treated as second class because we will not evaluate them in their educational progress. We will not evaluate the institutions into whose hands we place our children every day by the same standards as the school districts that we fund.
Yeah, I look at this.
And that's done, and this is the most frightening part and the most obscene part. This is all being done under color of public officialdom by no less than the Secretary of Education and the governor of this commonwealth.
If
I sound indignant, it's because I am.
And we should be. I mean, I'm angry, and I'm almost speechless because I look at this, and I've been following this, and I go back to, here to Harrisburg when they were fighting over, will the public school have kindergarten? And the law said, you know what, if you're not going to, you don't have to provide transportation for those public school kids, but for that charter school, for them, you have to provide transportation. And I look at the two sets of rules and the game that's rigged to destroy our public education, and it infuriates me.
Well, you know, if it wasn't so serious, I would afford myself the luxury of merely being infuriated.
But it's much more significant than that. I have said this repeatedly. You've heard me say it. Many of our listeners have heard me say it. The most important asset of any society, the most significant resource of any society, is our children. And this group of charlatans, this group of money changers, this group of political obscenities is all aimed at stripping our children of what? Of their future. And in so doing, someplace out there, there's a kid who would have found the cure for cancer. There's a kid who would have found the way to create a renewable energy source. There's a kid who will have figured out how to feed the hungry, who will not ever achieve that little dream because we decided to evaluate charter schools in a way that made them appear to be something that we all know they are not. And at the same time, and the postscript to this story that I'm going to tell you is maybe more troublesome even than the story itself. The beneficiaries of all this largesse, the privateers who are getting hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money every year to run these substandard charter schools, are passing out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of political contributions to Corbett and the people who support Corbett.
On both sides of the political aisle.
On all sides of the political aisle. But in the last week, right before the election, in that period that doesn't get reported until after the election is over, we found that Students First and some allied political action committees of this phony Students First organization that puts students anyplace but first gave out several hundred thousand dollars to their political acolytes. In one instance alone, in a state senate race in Allegheny County, more than $260,000 into the hands of one candidate who happened to have lost. And we all know what happened to State Representative Jim Roebuck from the Philadelphia area in the primary election when they spent nearly $500,000 to take him out in a primary. And we're still peeling the onion on these political contributions because in that last week there were political action committees that were invented out of whole cloth that were funded by other political action committees in the education, you know, in the charter school education community, all aimed at changing the complexion of the General Assembly to put a stamp of approval on these phony evaluation systems and on these substandard educational modalities, all with a dual aim of cheating our kids and cheating the taxpayers all in one fell swoop.
Well, the question that I have then is, how do we stop this? I mean, we know what the problem is. We know who's done this. How do we stop it?
What we need is something that has been kicked around and lied about in the Pennsylvania General Assembly for a couple of years. We need real charter school reform. Charter schools aren't going away, and if they're not going to go away, they need to be transparent. They need to be accountable. They need to be engaged in ethical practices.
And held to the same standard.
They need to be held at least to the same minimum standards as every other publicly funded educational institution. So, they like to call themselves public schools, but we know that they're private schools funded with public dollars, and we need a little bit of sunshine. So we need to stop these incestuous relationships where people who run charter schools hire their relatives to provide services to those charter schools and to sell goods to those charter schools and to have these cozy contracts where you and I both run a charter school, a separate one from each other, and I hire you to be a consultant, and you hire me to be a consultant. And we need to stop these crazy real estate deals where the taxpayers finance a school building, millions, tens of millions at times of renovations to a school building, and then it gets turned over to a charter operator for a dollar. And we need to prohibit statutorily these processes where charter operators get hold of a building and then charge 2 years of rent to the taxpayers in advance and still charge current rent as well for the building. And at the other end, the building isn't owned by the taxpayers who financed it, but by some private entrepreneur who's not particularly entrepreneurial, who has leased it for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to the taxpayers by way of a charter operator without any bids, and then still owns it after the taxpayers have paid for it. But mostly, and this is the significant one, we need to assure that these charter schools meet some reasonable minimum standards about how they are educating our children so that we don't have this problem of kids being victimized. And I mean the word victimized. This is child abuse, if there is any child abuse, by phony measurements and phony standards and phony ideas that treat their schools differently from the way we treat all other schools in reporting how they're doing.
Yeah.
Because we need to make sure that Sally and Johnny can read and write and add and subtract and multiply and divide and maybe use a computer and maybe be able to become employable in our society. And maybe one or another of those Sallys and Johnnies actually exceeds and excels and changes the world, like so many children in this country have before them.
Is there a movement of people doing this? I mean, are there groups out there that if I wanted to get involved or others wanted to get involved,
yes.
I mean, is there a grassroots movement of folks who are saying enough of this already?
Yeah, there is. The Education Law Center and the Education Policy and Law Center are doing wonderful work. There is actually a school board member from out in eastern Pennsylvania, a guy named Larry Feinberg, who is publishing about this literally every day. He publishes a blog and a clip service, and there are groups like the AFT of Pennsylvania, allied, interestingly enough, with the Pennsylvania School Boards Association and the Pennsylvania School Administrators Association and the Pennsylvania Association of Rural and Small Schools, all working together hand in hand, and together we're going to do what we need to do to propose reasonable reform legislation that brings charter schools under the sunshine and the antiseptic effect of sunshine.
Let me ask you last line of question, because, you know, I talk to a lot of friends like in my neighborhood who think this is an inner city thing, that this is, you know, the poor inner city schools that are going through this. The opportunities there, and it's never going to hit rural neighborhoods. It's not going to come to any of where I live. It's not my backyard, so it's not my problem. I see that as very short-sighted. I'm curious what your view is.
Oh, my view is exactly in line with yours. It couldn't be any more short-sighted. There are cyber charter schools that are operating that are cherry-picking kids from every school district in this state. Not merely the urban ones, but the suburban ones and the rural ones. And everybody needs to understand that while having 90 charter schools in the city of Philadelphia is very difficult and challenging, it's pulling $350 million a year out of the Philadelphia school district. Having one charter school in a school district in Lower Cumberland County or in Franklin County or in Perry County or in Fulton County or in Elk or Jefferson or Cameron County is devastating, because there is only one high school in many of those school districts. There is only one middle school in many of those districts. And in reality, everybody needs to understand and recognize that the cost of running that middle school building doesn't go down because we take 20 kids out and put them in charter schools, because they're not all from the same classroom. They're not even all from the same grade level. So we can't even get the hypothetical economic benefit of eliminating a teacher. But at the same time, the school building needs to be operated. It still needs a principal. It still needs an assistant principal. It still has all those bathrooms to run water through. It still has the whole building to heat. It still has the entire playground to have the grass cut. It still has all the walkways that need to be shoveled when it snows. It still has to light the building, and that cost is on the taxpayers, and it's spread across a smaller base, and it's spread across a smaller base that at the same time has been assaulted by those 20 kids funding mechanisms that have been taken away from the school district because the school district has to pay that out to the charter operators off the top, mandated, before they spend a dollar on their existing school population. So it's coming to a school district near you, I promise you.
Yeah,
and people need to understand it, and people need to deal with it, and people need to be ready for it.
Which is why I'm glad you've taken time to give us a little bit of information, and I hope you'll come back and keep us informed.
I pledge to do so. It is an issue that is daunting to me, and for some reason, no matter what I do, I can't seem to get too much distance between it and me. It seems to be one of those things that's defining this current piece of my career.
Well, I'm glad you're on this, and I'm glad you're here to tell us about it. I appreciate your time.
Good to be here. Have a great week and a great weekend.
All right, talk to you soon. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Quick break, back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. You are listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com. After saddling Hostess Brands with nearly $1 billion in debt, engaging in years of gross mismanagement, plunging the sugary snack maker into bankruptcy, and eliminating the middle-class jobs of some 18,000 Americans, shouldn't the owners and top executives at least have to say we're sorry and do some sort of penance? Of course they should. But don't hold your breath waiting for common ethics to flower in Hostess headquarters. After all, this is corporate world, a laissez-faire land where failure at the top is not punished, but magically rewarded. Thus, the maker of Twinkies, Ho-Hos, Ding-Dongs, and Devil Dogs has announced that 19 of the executives who made a mess of Hostess are now to be given $1.8 million in bonuses, on top of sweet pay raises they'd already grabbed. The bonuses were described as incentive pay to keep these geniuses on the job as they oversee the firing of all those workers. However, CEO Gregory Rayburn will not get a bonus, but shed no tears for him, since he's currently being paid $125,000 a month to dismantle the corporation. Also, while Lord Gregory has imposed a company-wide pay cut on management employees, he generously exempted himself from the hit. Talk about a devil dog. But wait, there's more. Satisfied with killing the jobs of 18,000 workers, Hostess Honchos also looted money that, by contract, was supposed to go into the workers' pension funds. As the company was sinking toward bankruptcy, the ding-dongs in the executive suite, who, remember, were giving themselves pay raises at the time, were secretly diverting worker pension money into corporate operations in a stopgap ploy to keep Hostess afloat and to disguise their incompetence. This is Jim Hightower saying, forget doing penance. These guys ought to be doing 10 to 20 in prison for grand larceny.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro if We'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
The goal really is to incentivize companies to come here in Pennsylvania, but not put it under pressure of the taxpayers. The companies have to make the investment. The companies have to hire somebody, or they get nothing. Not one red cent gets laid out by the Commonwealth, as it has in past programs. We think this is innovative and different than what other states are doing.
Yeah, it's innovative and it's different, just like 16 other states. Innovative and different, handing out tax dollars to corporations for doing what they were going to do anyway, business. It just blows my mind. It blows my mind that we've bought into this. And I look at this education situation, and you know, the more you get in, the more in depth you get into this story. And Irwin talked at length about what's going on in this state. I mean, but the more you get into how this whole thing came about, the wealth class of this country pushing, well, privatization while defunding public education. I mean, think about the last 2 years. You think about Corbett's down $1 billion each of the last 2 years with K-12 education gone. Can't put that back now. It's already gone. We laid off, what, 20,000 educators and support staff? Gone. And then you push for this privatization. And I go back to the fight at the beginning of this school year in Harrisburg, where the school district was seriously considering eliminating kindergarten because in the state of Pennsylvania, kindergarten is not mandated. It's not mandatory. So they were going to eliminate it. But you know who it was mandatory? For the charter schools. And the school district had to pay for transportation. And I look at that and I go, you know, the message there. And understand, they did this deliberately. They did it deliberately. So that when you start your child's education, you start it off in the charter school. Because, hey, you know what? You got to provide transportation right from the beginning. And if they want to do full day, absolutely. When the public school district who's footing the bill for the charter school can't provide full day kindergarten, you're going to go to the charter school and oh, you're already in the door. And they've got you. That was done on purpose. And I look at this and we've talked at length in the past about the Chester Upland School District who last year, a couple of months, they couldn't pay their teachers. They didn't have any money. Nothing. And the teachers went to work for free for months without a paycheck. And you look at that, but you know who got paid first? The charter schools, the for-profit charter schools, the charter school that pays the very wealthy people, you know, their service fees and their contracts. Not the teachers of the public school, no. That scenario, as I said then, will be replicated across this state. And the reality is they've got their snake oil. The latest snake oil is charter schools are the savior. Even though study after study has shown they actually do worse. And the cyber charter schools, well, forget about it. The whole online education thing, to me, as a sole education system, to me, a horrible direction. But the studies have shown, well, not working. And I look at the guy who may be the Republican nominee for president in 2016. They keep floating his name as somebody who may be the guy. Just what we need, another Bush. but the former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, who admittedly did some decent things while governor of Florida. You know how he did it? He actually invested in it. There was an intense focus on teaching reading and teaching math. And it did. It made a difference. They put money into it. But here's the thing. He took that, what you need to do, what you need to do is you need to get people focused on the problem, working smaller classes, more intense one-on-one educating. Not bigger class sizes, not eliminating programs, not slash and burn, not cut and punish, but actually investing it, and he did it. He put a bunch of money into education, and their scores went up. But now he's the guy who is leading one of these groups. It's his foundation. His group is the Foundation for Education or Excellence in Education. They've raised about $19 million in corporate money. They've raised a boatload of money. And what they're doing is they're trying to promote this agenda that he's come up with, which is not necessarily the one that he used. They're pushing charter schools. They're pushing cyber charter schools. They're pushing all of this online hocus pocus and all of this profiteering. Now understand what Jeb did in Florida, his Florida formula, if you will, was they increased accountability. They did. They graded schools on an A through F scale, gave, you know, based mostly on the student scores, but also on the standardized tests. And actually did something rare. Which, you know, how many people remember going to school and at the end of the year sweating whether you're going to get to go to the next grade? Evidently, we don't fail kids anymore. They, in Florida, actually, when 8-year-olds couldn't pass the state reading test, they failed them. They held them back, said, you know what, we're not going to let you go into the next grade. You're not going to go to fourth grade. You're not going to go on to the next grade until you can at least pass this. And I think that should be for every grade. And I look at this and I go, you know, there are smart ways of doing things, investing in teachers, investing in greater access to education, investing to more time, getting into the community, doing more of the hard work. None of this silver bullet stuff. But now that he's ahead of this foundation for excellence in education, you look at the people that are funding it, people like News Corp. You know who News Corp is? Yeah, Fox News. Think about this for a second. You've got the guy who's the head of, you've got Fox News funding education, for-profit education. Why do you think they're doing that? Well, I mean, for me, it comes down to a couple of things. One, first and foremost, there's big money to be had, which is why Bloomberg is involved in it. A lot of these billionaires are putting money into it. Not because they're benevolent, not because they're philanthropic, because there's a profit, there's a return on investment. That's the reason they're doing it. But moreover, it's ideological as well. They could promote their message. They could promote their worldview. Now, the guy who is the head of News Corp's education division, a guy named Joel Klein, he used to be the New York City school head. Now he's the guy who does News Corp's education division. Wow. He said, you know, we give money to Bush's foundation, you know, not to promote broad policy, you know, not our own financial interest, but because we believe in better education. He said any application that corporate donors give us, give money to advance their agenda, well, just wrong. And I stop and I think about this. And I go, you know, Why would a billionaire give Bush's group a couple hundred thousand dollars, a couple million dollars, $19 million at last count? Well, especially when you run a company that profits off education. What do you think? What do you think? What does the sniff test tell you? What does common sense tell us? I mean, for me, you know, I guess it's because I lived through busing. I lived through the 70s when they told us the silver bullet to fixing education in the poor inner city schools was the ship poor kids from one side of town to the other, was rearranging the poor people, and also keeping them occupied, which, you know, everybody was against. And who ended up getting rich? Well, a handful. The people who made the buses, really. The bus companies, because a lot of that was privatized as well. These silver bullets, folks, don't work. And I know it's easy to say this is a Philadelphia problem or this is an inner city problem. It's not. This theft of education is a statewide, is a national problem, because this is a national fake movement. And the goal is, as we've been saying, to destroy public education, is to deny that one shot that the people like me had. Now, I worry and I fear for the day that kids get an education. Because remember, as we go down the road and these vouchers, because vouchers are coming, you know it's going to happen. You know, they're working toward that. But what worries me is down the road, when we've split up education, we've divided the pot, and the public schools that are left are crumbling and deteriorating because there's no money to invest in them, because we're paying out all of these for-profit, ideologically religious-based schools. If you don't fit into those molds, if you don't fit into that ideology, if you don't fit into that way of thinking, if your lottery number doesn't come up, what are you left with? And the kid who doesn't have parents who are going to know how to navigate the system, the kid who has parents who, well, couldn't be bothered, they're going to be the ones who are going to be left out and shut out of opportunity. And that worries me. Worries me a lot. And I see this whole scenario being set up where you and I, we're the ones who are being fleeced. And our kids, their future, that much less bright. This is wrong. And someone needs to be held accountable. And look, there's an election coming up in 2014, and this governor's got to be held accountable. It's that simple to me. Let's take a quick break. Right back with the second hour of the program. Stick around.
One, two.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 600 workers at 5 nursing home facilities in Connecticut who have been on strike more than 5 months have been reinstated by a federal judge in Hartford. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
All right, guys, so we're going to have people from the other picket lines come in here throughout the day, okay? We're having a lot of politicians, a lot of community people tonight, okay? This is the time to show this company that we won, right?
That was Jesse Martin, an organizer with the New England Healthcare Employees Union, District 1199, speaking to workers at Healthbridge's West River Nursing Home in Milford last Thursday morning. The company had locked out the workers at that site exactly 1 year before, and a prolonged candlelight vigil to mark the anniversary turned into a celebration instead. After 113 days, a judge ordered the company to end the lockout, and 2 months later, in mid-June, Healthbridge imposed its own contract. The company's offer froze pensions and raised workers' health insurance premiums by at least $6,000 more per year for family coverage. It also took back 6 paid sick days and a week's vacation for many employees. So workers at all 5 facilities walked out. On December 12th, Federal Judge Robert Schettini ruled that the company had refused to bargain in good faith and had imposed the cuts unilaterally. He ordered all the workers reinstated by Monday, December 17th. Noreen Gates, a 20-year employee who's the central supply coordinator, said the company underestimated the workers' determination.
When they locked us out last December, I think that they felt that they locked just West River out and not the others because they felt that we were the weakest link in the union. And it's kind of backfired in a way because this line is stronger than ever now.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Milford, Connecticut.
Clear Channel is turning off the broadcasting antenna at WDTW in Detroit, taking the Progressive Talk AM station dark at the end of December. This follows the end of Progressive Talk at KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, and at KFNQ in Seattle. Tony Truppiano hosts daily First Shift pro-labor talk show on WDTW in Detroit. He knew after the passage of the anti-union so-called right-to-work legislation in Michigan that it would be harder to continue to rely on labor union sponsors to keep his show thriving. Truppiano is devastated by the decision, but told his listeners he hopes that they carry on their struggle for economic and social justice for working people.
I am heartbroken. I am devastated. I can't thank you enough for everything you have done to fight for the good people of the state of Michigan and in our communities. It is critical to me that no matter if I'm on the air or not, whether I'm leading you or not, that you continue to fight this fight that is so critical to restore some sanity as we move forward.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the first hour of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So conservative blue dog Democrat Heath Shuler, he retired, didn't run for re-election. He'll be done, January of this coming year. So what's he going to do? You know, where is he going to go? What is the former blue dog going to do with his time? Maybe putz around the garage, maybe do a little gardening? What do you think? Well, I think he's going to do like most swinging door type politicians. Going to take a job with big industry. And what I find interesting is, you know, people, our friends that we've had on the program, Lee Fang and Zed Jelani, they had a conversation with Heath, or with Shuler, listen to this exchange.
About a month or two ago, that you're already negotiating for a lobby job because you're retiring this year.
No, I'm on the phone with my wife.
But you're not negotiating with the majority group or any of these other lobbying firms on K Street?
No, you read it wrong, buddy.
What are you doing? Why are you holding these meetings with them?
I'm not holding meetings with them.
So you've never met with majority group?
No. Rob worked for me.
Uh-huh.
Walt was my colleague.
Uh-huh.
I can have a conversation with him.
Are you planning to become a lobbyist?
No.
So what do you have influence industry at all after this year?
Guys, you're on record here.
The wrong tree,
my friend.
What do you plan to do after you retire?
Have a better job than you guys have, that's for sure.
Have a better job. He's going to have fun with his wife. I don't know what kind of fun he's going to have with it. Well, maybe his wife's name is Duke Energy. Maybe his wife's name's Duke. You know, who knows? He said he was going to have fun with his wife. Maybe Duke is his wife's name, because the press release that I saw the other day, Duke Energy has named Heath Shuler as a senior vice president of federal affairs. Now, as we know, he currently serves as a member of the House of Representatives. The press release says he has represented North Carolina's 11th district since 2007. His term expires January 3rd, 2013. He announced his intention to retire from Congress, and they're thrilled. They're pleased to have him. He's going to work on building their federal affairs team. He's going to work with their energy associates at Duke Energy, because, he's just a guy who knows a lot about energy, right? It's not that he was a congressman who's got tons of connections. No, no. Couldn't possibly be it. Uh-huh. And I look at this and I go, this swinging door. And he's not the only one. I mean, there have been numerous congressmen, tons of them, who have then gone to the corporate side and used the influence and the connections that they had while representing us in Congress, to benefit the handfuls. And I am a firm believer that, if you want to be a lobbyist, 5 years. There's got to be a five-year window. There's got to be something that says, this swinging door, bad idea. We've got to do something to tap down the power that these lobbyists, something. Because the special interests seem to have, because they've got all the money, they seem to have the ability to, get what they want at our expense. I mean, there's a lot of things wrong in Washington, and one of the big ones to me is this swinging door. I go back, and I'll, for as long as I live, I'll never forget the guy from Louisiana, Billy Townsend, who back in 06, rammed through he got the votes to push Bush's prescription drug bill, that Part D, that Big Pharma wanted in the worst way. The one that said, we're not going to negotiate for prices. We're going to pay full price. We're going to pay manufacturer's suggested retail price. In fact, we're going to pay manufacturer's demanded price. Not going to negotiate like every other rational, reasonable person. No, no. We're Americans. We pay full price. And then as soon as it passes, and this is the part that just blows my mind, as soon as it passes, he resigns. Leaves Congress. In the middle of his term, he's not done yet. At least Schuler is going to wait until the day after he's done. This guy, no, I'm not going to wait to the end. There's a big job here. Whole bunch of money, a big pot of gold at the end of, to reward me for my work. Now understand, Big Pharma wanted this. They lobbied heavily for the prescription drug plan, the one where we don't negotiate for prices. And then the guy who was instrumental in twisting the arms and getting the votes, he resigns from Congress and becomes the head of Big Pharma. And that's not illegal. Let that sink in for a second. I mean, that's the, it's easy. I should be a right winger. I really should. I should be one of these crazy, I should be Beck and Limbaugh and all of them. Government's no guys, no good government, guys. Government's broken. No, because it's easy. It's really, man, it is easy to take pot shots. It is easy to tear things down. I've always likened it to building a house. I can tear a house down like nobody's business. I got a hammer. I got matches. We can take a house down. No problem. Any idiot can do that. Any doofus can destroy a house. You got to actually have some intellect and some ability, some skill to build the house. And I look at that with our friends on the right. It's easy to tear things apart. It's easy to destroy things. And I look at someone like Towson, and you go, here's a guy, government's no good, they can't do anything right. They pass legislation designed the poison pill to destroy Medicare. And here we are years later going, we need concessions from Medicare. We need to reform it. We need to push it off. We need to do all these draconian things because, the poison pills are working. Our poison is working. It's mind-blowing, man. Absolutely mind-blowing. and yet we put up with it. And we buy into it. You know, what's it going to take? What's it going to take for us to wake up and stop nonsense like this? The swinging door. You know, it's easy to take those pot shots. It sure as hell is. And I look right now. You know, what are the other things that I see wrong in Washington? Things that we can solve. Things we can fix. Things we can do. This filibuster thing. There's a group right now, fixthesenatenow.org, the website. Group of folks coming through saying, you know what? We need to fix this filibuster thing. We can't have a senator sitting in his office going, well, I'm gonna put a hold on that. We're going to filibuster that. Because I've said if I was Harry Reid, what I would do, and now look, I'm not saying you do away with the filibuster. You don't do away with it. Because you've got to have a way for the minority to stop things that they find truly abhorrent. But I say you need to get them to hold the floor. You know, when Mr. Smith went to Washington and we all saw the movie and how he held it and he made his case, an impassioned plea. We need to do that now. And everything else stops. You hold the floor, you make your case, and you stay on topic. None of this nonsense. We're going to read the newspaper or ramble on. Talk about the issue. Actually debate the issue. And you know what? We got C-SPAN. We can put it on TV. We can put it on radio. And you and me and we, the people, we see this. And we hold those accountable who are gridlocking our system. We hold those accountable who are the ones who have created the mess that we're in. I look at the last Congress? The 112th? What was it last year? 385 filibusters? 385? Really? I mean, it's amazing anything gets done whatsoever. But just in that period, 385. That means bills like the Disclose Act, for instance, filibuster. It's like the Employee Free Choice Act, filibuster. Things that would have created jobs, the Jobs Act, the Bring the Jobs Home Act, filibuster. And no one knows why. That's the thing that drives me nuts. If you've got a true, and this is what I said about the Employee Free Choice Act, if you have a true objection to it, you should be out there making your case. And the American people should be able to see it. Same thing with the Jobs Act or the Disclose Act or any of the other things, the Clean Energy and Security Act, a lot of this stuff should be out there in front, in open public for all of us to see. None of this, we're going to hide behind the cloak of rule, of this arcane rule. I mean, it's amazing to me. And, you know, I've been talking today to some folks about this. And I think most people agree with me. The filibuster should be truly a filibuster. You get up there and you make your case. You get up on that soapbox and you make your case. And we fix this. And we hold the floor and you make them stay on topic and you make them debate. End this silent filibuster. And at the end of the day, I mean, and look, you know, understand, when the Republicans take the Senate back at some point in the future, and they will, I mean, they've got the ebbs and flows, the Democrats aren't going to control it forever, just like the Republicans aren't going to control the House forever. You've got to deal with it on both sides of the equation. Maybe that once you have it in that structure, then you start working together to try and go, you know what, we're going to avoid those filibusters. Because I was looking at this graph that just blew my mind. Because, you know, this whole filibuster thing, really started in the 70s. You know, up until the 70s, when you had these real ideological the rule changes, by the way. You didn't have it. I mean, there were years where you had one, maybe two filibusters. You know, there were Congresses. I think the Congress from 52 to 56 had one filibuster. The Congress from 58 to 64 had nine. But by the time you got to the 70 to 76 era, you're looking at 100. Then you get to the Clinton years. And you see 222, and you get to the Bush years, 200. And now the Obama years, 385? It's outrageous. Something needs to be done to rein this in. To me, it's that simple. I'm going to take a quick break. Be back with this. Stick around.
Con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Homeowners, cold weather is almost upon us. Use the equity in your house to keep warm and toasty all winter long. Save your energy with new windows and keep the outside out, the inside in. Or roll out a new carpet for those holiday guests. Stop sending money out the door and get it on the house. With a home equity line of credit from PSECU. You can borrow up to 80% of your home's value at just a 3.25 annual percentage rate with a PSECU home equity line of credit. Other rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/HELOC.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
After saddling Hostess Brands with nearly $1 billion in debt, engaging in years of gross mismanagement, plunging the sugary snack maker into bankruptcy, and eliminating the middle-class jobs of some 18,000 Americans, shouldn't the owners and top executives at least have to say we're sorry and do some sort of penance? Of course they should. But don't hold your breath waiting for common ethics to flower in Hostess headquarters. After all, this is corporate world, a laissez-faire land where failure at the top is not punished but magically rewarded. Thus, the maker of Twinkies, Ho-Hos, Ding Dongs, and Devil Dogs has announced that 19 of the executives who made a mess of Hostess are now to be given $1.8 million in bonuses on top of sweet pay raises they'd already grabbed. The bonuses were described as incentive pay to keep these geniuses on the job as they oversee the firing of all those workers. However, CEO Gregory Rayburn will not get a bonus, but shed no tears for him, since he's currently being paid $125,000 a month to dismantle the corporation. Also, while Lord Gregory has imposed a company-wide pay cut on management employees, he generously exempted himself from the hit. Talk about a devil dog. But wait, there's more. Not satisfied with killing the jobs of 18,000 workers, Hostess Honchos also looted money that, by contract, was supposed to go into the workers' pension funds. As the company was sinking toward bankruptcy, the ding-dongs in the executive suite, who, remember, were giving themselves pay raises at the time, were secretly diverting worker pension money into corporate operations in a stopgap ploy to keep Hostess afloat and to disguise their incompetence. This is Jim Hightower saying, forget doing penance. These guys ought to be doing 10 to 20 in prison for grand larceny.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Let my daddy come.
Grandma knew how it works when he came home from World War II. How the yard's just a scrap and rubble. Most of them big boys did what Hitler couldn't do. Yeah, these mills that built the tanks and bombs that won this country's war. We sent our sons to Korea and Vietnam. Now we're wondering what they were to die for. Here it comes now. Here it comes now.
Well, the CEO class, they're going to save the day. They are running a campaign called Fix the Debt. Yes, fix the debt. We're going to fix the debt by how? Much like we've done with most things, like Corbett has done here in Pennsylvania in closing their budget holes. Screw the people at the bottom. We're gonna go after people who, well, basically voiceless, defenseless. You know, seniors, workers, those people. And these CEOs, these 71 big CEOs, the Fix the Debt CEOs, people like Lloyd Blankenfein, who are advocating, you know, pushing the retirement age down the road, changing how benefits are calculated, because, you know, we need to hold them down, you know, need to hold down those costs there. These are guys who have huge pensions. I mean, Blankenfein had like a $12 million pension fund. $12 million. And do you know what the average person, the average Social Security check now is? It's about $1,200 a month. If you look at Blankenfein, his $12 million, you know, that comes up to, you know, what, $90,000, $100,000 a month? And he's worried about some poor schmuck who made it to 65? Or when I 67 for me? And the answer, I guess, is yes. And I look at this study just put out by the Institute for Policy Studies titled Pension Deficit Disorder. They looked at the 71 Fix the Debt CEOs, you know, of these publicly held companies who had an average retirement of about $9.1 million. So these are people who really, they're never going to have to, they're not worried about that $1,200 that they're getting from Social Security. No, 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 because they're going to be getting about $66,000 a month for life, not a year, a month. And these are the same people, and this is what drives me nuts. They've created this illusion of a crisis. Now understand, Social Security has some minor problems that need to be addressed. Nobody's going to say everything's wonderful and the future's rosy. There are some things that we need to do. One, the first thing we need to do for all of our problems is create jobs. That should be the focus. If you had more people paying in, guess what? You don't have the unfunded portion of the liability. You got people paying into the system. Makes perfect sense. The other part of it is, why do we have a cap on it? Explain to me the rationale. Explain to me the sense that the guy who's driving the truck or driving the bus or swinging the hammer, driving the nail or stringing the electric lines, why they're paying 100% of the Social Security tax, while someone who made a bet on Wall Street's paying nothing, while someone who's making like Mitt Romney $25 million is only paying on the first $106,800. Explain the rationale behind that. It makes no sense. No sense whatsoever. So I look at this report that they've put out, and they looked at some of the executives who, you know, they have not just the average of $9.1 million, some of them got $20 million in retirement, $110,000 a year if you put it into an annuity. And you look at these people who are just, but I guess what bothers me in all of this is you've got folks who are doing wildly well, who have done really extraordinarily well off of the backs of folks who They're the ones who... And these 71 CEOs of the 71 pension funds for their workers. Of those, only two of them were fully funded, where they were going to meet their obligation. That means 39 of them were not. And in fact, they had an unfunded liability of $103 billion. About $2.5 billion on average. These are the same people who are pushing for the state governments to go after their workers and change the defined benefit plan and these bad, horrible contribution plans. And it's been the push of the last 30 years to destroy that retirement security that people like you and me and working people across this country for a very short time were able to enjoy. I mean, my grandparents' generation were one of a few generations throughout the history of civilization that have been able, where working people actually had a little bit of security in their old age, where they weren't going to have to worry about, am I going to lose my house if I get sick? For a very short period of time, there was some security there. And the wealth class of this country, along with the Republicans and some Democrats too, I'm guessing, they're going to be the ones who want to scale that back. You shouldn't have so much security. And you look, since 1985, you've seen over 84,000 pension plans eliminated. And a lot of that had to do with the corporate rating of the 80s and 90s, where the Bain Capitals, where these private equity firms came in and basically borrowed everything from the pension fund. The company went bankrupt. Oh, gee, sorry. Happens. Bad. And guess who got stuck holding the bag? Well, first the workers. They got screwed because they lost their pension. I know a bunch of people who are stuck. And well, I guess fortunate enough, one, that the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, actually gave them about 40% of what they were entitled to, or what they, I shouldn't even say entitled to, what they earned, what was to be theirs, had it not been mismanaged and stolen. And at the end, who got stuck footing the rest of the bill? Well, the taxpayers. Because these corporations walk away from that responsibility. The very people who are telling us, well, you know what, we need to push Social Security off further. We need to push that Medicare down the road further. It's ridiculous and nonsensical. But that's what they've created. This is that next line of concessions that they keep saying, well, you know, times are tough. We need shared sacrifice. I look at these 71 CEOs. I'm not seeing the sharing. You know, if you cut 10% of their pay, do you think their standard of living changes at all? If you cut 20% of their pay, do you think it changes? No. You cut 10% from a guy making 10 bucks an hour, from a woman making 12 bucks an hour, that is a major lifestyle change. You cut 10% from the retirement benefit that people are planning on, that is a major change in retirement security. You push off Medicare for another year, that is a major change in security. It's not shared sacrifice. It's extortion. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet?
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania.
Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Arterian's attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
You often hear the mass of our Milky Way galaxy is equal to several hundred billion stars, like our sun.
Now, some astronomers are suggesting more mass for our Milky Way. 1.6 trillion suns.
The new estimate is based on the first ever measurement of the proper motion, or sideways motion, of a small satellite galaxy to our Milky Way. Our galaxy has some 24 known satellite galaxies. This one is called LEO 1.
If you knew the size of the orbits of these Milky Way satellites, their speeds in orbit, and how long they take to orbit our galaxy, you could use the laws of physics to calculate the amount of mass in the Milky Way. But our human lifespans are short in contrast to the lifespans and motions of the galaxies. So these numbers are hard to come by.
Astronomers used the Hubble Space Telescope to compare LEO 1's position in 2006 and 2011 with more than 100 background galaxies to obtain the first measurement of its proper motion. Then they used that number to estimate that LEO 1 orbits at 200 kilometers per second, nearly as fast as our sun.
But LEO 1 is much farther away than our sun from the galaxy's center. And that means the Milky Way must be much more massive than previously believed. The new mass estimate is 1.6 trillion solar masses. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Milky Way mass. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
About the free exercise of religion. And under our Constitution, you don't take a poll to find out how people feel about a constitutional freedom. In fact, the Bill of Rights are designed to protect minority views. So what the overall view on the issue of contraception is has nothing to do with an issue about religious freedom. And in this country, the government doesn't get to tell you or your organization what your religious views are. And they could well be minority views. But the Bill of Rights is designed to protect the minority from the will of the majority.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So this whole filibuster issue, from the beginning, you know, this has been a couple of years now, I've been fuming about this. I do believe it's something that we should be 385 filibusters in the last couple of years, just outrageous. And this is what's really, I think, in my opinion, has gridlocked our Congress. I'm all in favor of there being a filibuster as long as you hold the floor and you debate the issue. Simple stuff to me. But here to talk a little bit more about it, I've got David Waldman, contributing editor over at Daily Kos and the host of KGRO in the Morning. David, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, thanks, Rick. No problem at all.
You know, I look at this again. It's popped up. I mean, they're going to be issuing. They're going to be doing the rules again here very soon. And every Congress, you get this issue to pop up again. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, it doesn't happen all that often that they get a clear shot at changing something as long-lasting as the filibuster rules. But in between their attempt at it last time and this time, between then, I guess the last serious effort that had any chance of succeeding at changing filibuster rules was 35 years before that. In 1975 was really the last time they made a major successful revision of this. But in the last couple of years, it's popped up a lot because, as you mentioned, the numbers of filibusters have gone way up. I mean, through the roof, unlike anything ever before in history. And it's made itself an issue. It's unavoidable. And so you're seeing it come up every 2 years now. And if they can't get it right this time, you know, you'll see it happen again.
Right. Since they seem to love, crisis situation, could this be the filibuster cliff?
Could be. They seem to like to turn everything into it. But that's just exactly the kind of thing that is created by the use of the filibuster in every situation. Not only this now, this nonsense, but the fiscal cliff. But a couple of years ago, you know, we were facing a federal government default with the debt ceiling because same thing, you could hold anything hostage. So health care bill, federal deficit, the debt ceiling, fiscal cliff, anything you want. That's one of the big problems with this thing.
Yeah, well, when you've got a party in this country that believes in scorched earth,
yeah,
the sky's the limit, I guess, or the scorched earth is the limit.
Yeah, and not only do they believe in scorched earth policies, but these are the guys who, they make their bank on saying that the government doesn't work and can't work, and to prove it, they won't let it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that gets me. I mean, I talk to voters all the time who, say, well, I'm voting for this candidate because, he believes in, limited, smaller government. And I'm going, but hold on. This is the guy who tells you government can't work. He doesn't believe in government. Why would you vote for him to run your government?
Right.
Because
small or large,
he's going to screw it up. And he's telling you, I'm going to screw it up. And you're going to vote for it. It's one of those things that's always just blown my mind. But back to this filibuster thing. Because I'm not against the idea of a filibuster. I saw Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I kind of agree with that model of it. Look, if you truly have an objection to something coming up, you should have to hold the floor and you should have to debate that issue. I don't want people reading Moby Dick or War and Peace, but actually debating the issue and talking about it. To me, that seems rational.
Yeah, and I think to a lot of people it does. I mean, at the very least, even if you allowed for people to read out of the phone book, the idea that stopping every piece of business moving through the United States Senate should actually be the easiest thing there is to do in the Senate is absurd. You can leave a filibuster in the rules in place. It just should be work to have to conduct one. I don't think anybody objects if you put it that way. Even when you ask Republican senators, shouldn't you have to show people that you're working hard to stop something you object to strenuously? I don't understand why you get to go home and take a nap. They have a hard time answering for that.
And shouldn't I know who's done it? I mean, a lot of these filibusters, we don't even know who the hell did it.
Right, yeah. A new quirk in the rules, new meaning since the 70s, I guess, when you're talking about the entire history of the Senate. It was a reform that was put in place that was supposed to allow the Senate to move on to other business when people had determined, when they said they're going to filibuster something and block it, at least it wouldn't block everything. But in the unexpected outcome of that is now when you face a filibuster, if you don't have the time or you can't find the votes to beat it, you put a bill aside and move on to something else. And that's just as good as talking it to death, is letting it sit there and languish. So you get silent filibusters where nobody comes to the floor. The only reason something's not coming is someone told someone else they were going to filibuster it, and that's enough.
So, in talking, as you pointed out, the last real reform was in the 70s. And, I'm looking at this graph from the people at fixthesenatenow.org where they show, throughout, from 1918 all the way up until the 70s, there was a handful of filibusters a year or presidential term. And then, into the 70s, man, it just skyrockets until this last presidential term from 2008 to 2012, where you saw 385 of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess maybe it's time to go back at changes, because I would argue it's not for the better.
Yeah, it certainly hasn't made things work any better. And even the Senate of the 70s was just sort of a different place. For one thing, you actually ended up with a bipartisan agreement on changing the filibuster rules, and something that is not, well, it's not out of the question, but it's going to take some work to get something like that this time. But, you know, one of the crazy things about the filibuster that gets claimed all the time at the moment by Republicans is they say, well, we need the filibuster around because it helps ensure, it guarantees, it makes necessary bipartisan agreements. But I think the way things have worked out between this and the silent filibuster and the rise of a Republican Party that simply is, you know, is betting everything on not allowing anything to happen, that's actually part of their agenda, to make sure that nothing happens. That's what's really unusual, and what's begun to happen here is that you find that the filibuster actually takes apart the ability to compromise, because it takes away the necessity of bending. If you know that you can block anything at all that you want forever, then there's no incentive whatsoever to try and cut a deal.
Because I would argue that, you know, that what you're saying is true, that they thought that having this secret filibuster would make people compromise more. It doesn't make any sense to me. Having to actually go through the work of holding the floor and go through the work of standing there and even just reading out of the phone book, where everybody is going to see, especially your constituents, I would think that that would be something that would lead to more bipartisanship and lead to more willingness to compromise, because who wants to go through 48 hours of reading the phone book?
Right. Well, it may just do that. But, yeah, when in places where the filibuster is finally out of the way, either on the budget where it's not allowed or on bills where they've finally gotten cloture, what tends to happen when they know that the bill, in this case, the train is leaving the station and it's clear that something's going to pass, that's when the people who are on the other side begin to scramble and look for deals. What can I put in this bill to sweeten it for me and make it at least bearable to have this thing pass? That's when they start making deals. When they know they can block it forever, they're not interested. And when they know they can block it forever without looking like an idiot on national television, well, that's just an open invitation.
Yeah, it's just going to continue. You know, there was talk a couple years ago about the nuclear option. Any talk of that here lately?
Well, more than there had been in the past. And there was they even fought about what they were going to name this thing. And each side then blamed the other for coming up with the name nuclear option. But as it happens, it was, in fact, Trent Lott, Republican Senate leader at the time, who came up with the name for it. And at that time, this was in about 2005, it was Republicans in control of the Senate and Democrats blocking some judicial nominees from President George W. Bush. And when they came up with this, they actually decided they wanted to call it, the Republicans, the constitutional option, which is the name that's now being used again by the Democrats, who are talking about doing the same thing. And all of a sudden, those Republicans now say, no, it's the nuclear option, after having spent 2005 insisting, no, please don't call it that. That's not really what it is. But, yeah, that's exactly what they would be talking about using again to change the rules. It's an interesting theory, and it can be used in a variety of different ways. It can be used very recklessly, as the Republicans considered in 2005, changing the rules in the middle of a session in May of 2005. Or it can be used on a planned basis at the beginning of a new Congress that happens only once every 2 years on a regular basis. Everybody knows it's coming, and that's what the Democrats are talking about using this time.
Do you think they'll have a spine and actually do something?
I think they will do something. The question is, how far will they go, and what mechanism will they use to do it? I think that they have come to the realization that, at the very least, if you can credibly threaten that you have a majority to push through the change that you want using the nuclear or constitutional option, again, that's another example of when the other side comes around looking for a deal. They see the train's leaving the station, the rules are going to change. If I'd like to have any impact on those rules and guarantee any rights for the minority, it's time to come talking about a deal. And that's exactly how things have changed in the past. Every time they've threatened to use this, and shown that they've had the votes, the other side has come around and said, not only do we see that something is going to happen here, but we hate this procedure so much, we're so afraid of it, that we'll give you what you want and the votes you need to do it with the traditional two-thirds if you'll just cut us in on the deal.
Right.
And that may be what happens again.
And this is where you go, okay, this is where you get that compromise.
Yeah.
Because the Democrats have to be careful because I think it's pretty safe to say they're not going to be the majority forever. And this, the rules that they impose may end up coming around and biting them in the long run.
Yeah. And that's what's leading them to try and be careful about how far they go with the reform. A lot of us would like to see either the elimination of the filibuster altogether, or some would say, well, in addition to making them talk, we ought to impose some additional burden. We ought to make it so that the people who support continuing the debate, that is, blocking cloture and continuing the filibuster, have to stay on the floor whether they're talking or not. And that would really make it difficult for them to continue this. They could switch off who talks, but if they couldn't leave and they couldn't go do their fundraisers and couldn't meet with constituents or go to committee meetings, those filibusters would end a hell of a lot faster and there'd be a hell of a lot less of them. But the senators who are proposing this reform are mindful of the fact that they're not always going to be in the majority. They want a rule that they can live with if they're in the minority, and that's as far as they want to go. And it's hard to criticize that. That's what we want out of these guys.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I would hope they would do on just about everything.
Yeah.
What would the world look like without the filibuster?
Well, it would largely look like, well, for one thing, we'd probably have a better health care plan that would have come out of the Affordable Care Act. I don't know that you necessarily would have gotten as far as some of the, say, single-payer activists would have wanted, but you might have had a much better shot at something approximating it, like
the public option,
right? You'd probably have, well, if you didn't have the filibuster at all, I know that, think about all the things that failed by just a few votes in the last couple of years, including Employee Free Choice Act comes to mind pretty quickly there, too. That might have made a big difference. You might have had a very different looking Supreme Court and federal judiciary that would be deciding a whole host of important cases in different ways. And, well, on the other hand, you might not have Elizabeth Warren in the Senate either. She'd be at the Consumer Finance Protection Agency.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. But also you go back to the Bush years, you think about some of the insanity that went on then as well, which
mm-hmm.
is why I'm not in favor of doing away with it entirely.
Yeah.
You know, so we'll see. I guess prediction, where do you think they're going to come up with something?
I do. I think they can't avoid it, and Harry Reid is too committed to it. And I think that there's probably a package of reforms that they could even get some Republican agreement on, though they won't admit it until they see that their backs are to the wall. One of the things they want to do is get rid of the filibuster of the motion to proceed, which it was always there. It was just rarely used because no one thought it made any sense. It didn't make any particular sense to filibuster the motion to take up a bill that you then planned to filibuster, and it just wasn't done. But now that we're in the era of Republicans looking to block everything and eat up as much time as they can, you find stupid procedural motions that used to be taken for granted and granted by unanimous consent at that being filibustered. So they want to get rid of that. That has the additional effect, by the way, of getting rid of secret holds, or at least removing the power that holds have in the Senate. So that's helpful. There are also a couple of procedural motions once a bill does pass that can block it from going to conference. They'll probably do something about that. And if we're lucky, they'll give a shot at least. They'll start looking at ways to reverse the burden for keeping a filibuster going. Rather than, this would be the big prize, rather than requiring 60 votes to end a filibuster, if they could rewrite the rules so that it required 41 votes to continue one, that would go a long way towards making it possible to get some of these things closed down after a reasonable amount of debate. I think everybody would get out of the way for a little while, let the debate go on for a couple of days, as so long as the people who were debating actually showed up to do the work, and then take a vote again in a couple of days. That would really be one of the better outcomes. Whether they can get to that, I'm not sure. But I think getting rid of some of these procedural filibusters will be a big help, and getting rid of the hold will be at least helpful in terms of transparency, who's doing what.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping for something, because 4 more years of what happened the last 2, the gridlock, the delay, the obstruction, not good for the country, not good for the recovery of the economy, and definitely not good for working people of this country. David Waldman, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. No problem.
David Waldman, contributing editor over at Daily Coast, also a host of KGRO in the Morning. Quick break, right back after this. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Earth, sky.
You often hear the mass of our Milky Way galaxy is equal to several hundred billion stars, like our sun.
Now, some astronomers are suggesting more mass for our Milky Way, 1.6 trillion suns.
The new estimate is based on the first ever measurement of the proper motion, or sideways motion, of a small satellite galaxy to our Milky Way. Our galaxy has some 24 known satellite galaxies. This one is called LEO 1.
If you knew the size of the orbits of these Milky Way satellites, their speeds in orbit, and how long they take to orbit our galaxy, you could use the laws of physics to calculate the amount of mass in the Milky Way. But our human lifespans are short in contrast to the lifespans and motions of the galaxies. So these numbers are hard to come by.
Astronomers used the Hubble Space Telescope to compare LEO 1's position in 2006 and 2011 with more than 100 background galaxies to obtain the first measurement of its proper motion. Then they used that number to estimate that LEO 1 orbits at 200 kilometers per second, nearly as fast as our sun.
But LEO 1 is much farther away than our sun from the galaxy's center, and that means the Milky Way must be much more massive than previously believed. The new mass estimate is 1.6 trillion solar masses. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Milky Way mass. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
We imagine a pink unicorn. Now, if you had a pink unicorn, how many dollars in taxes would you raise to trade for the pink unicorn? Since pink unicorns do not exist in the real world, it has never occurred to me to worry about the senator from South Carolina. He's not going to vote for a deal because the kind of 10-to-1 ratio deal he's talking about with real ironclad spending cuts is never going to happen.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
Did I miss something in that? Did he say that Lindsey Graham wanted 10-to-1 cuts? I don't remember him saying that. I don't remember him being nailed down on any of that. I remember him saying, and look, he's couching it. Well, we need you know, to go after those people on Social Security and people who need Medicaid and those, you know, granny on Medicare. But he didn't, I don't remember him saying 10 to 1. I don't know where that came from. I do, however, remember all of the Republican presidential candidates raising their hand, agreeing that they would not take 10 to 1. They would raise revenue under no circumstances. So I guess, you know, you look at that just in this short period of time, you know, that election thing where they got thumped, where Grover has taken the beating. Because you had all of those presidential candidates, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, were there saying, no, I wouldn't raise taxes even 1%. If I could get 10% cuts, wouldn't do it. Would not do it. Poor Grover. And you know what? I look at this, and you know, the thing that bothers me is that the folks at the very top have never been doing better. And you've got an entire political party in this country who staked, if you buy the whole cliff thing, if you buy it's the end of civilization and it's Armageddon if we go over this imaginary, this mirage, if we go over the, you know, the big cliff, that somehow happens. If there were a cliff and somehow we went over it, if you buy that, it blows my mind that they would take us to that, to the brink of that, just for people who have done wildly well. I mean, and you look at the fact that they have never done better, and they're doing better every year. You look at people with incomes over $10 million a year. They have seen their tax rate fall from 22.4% in 2009 to 20.7% in 2010. And, of course, the Wall Street Journal points out why. Well, it's the Bush tax cuts. And what blows my mind is, you know, you keep hearing the GOP going on about, well, you know, it's going to hurt small business, even though we know 3% of small businesses bring home more than $200,000 or $250,000 for a couple that would be affected by this. 3%. So again, you know, you were talking about small numbers of people. But as the Wall Street Journal points out, the reason for the drop in average tax rates is no secret. They said it's the special 15% top rates for capital gains and dividends that George W. Bush pushed through. They write, in 2009, taxpayers with incomes exceeding $10 million reported 35.8% of their income as capital gains and dividends. That rose to 48.5% in 2010. That means the wealth class has figured out the loophole. Make your income something that looks like capital gains or dividends. Tie your compensation to something else. Which is why I've always believed, I don't care how you derive your income. Betting on Wall Street, betting on the big lotteries coming up, should be taxed the same. But think about this before we go to break. Let's say you win the Powerball, $550 million. Compare that to where if you made a bet on Wall Street and made $550 million. Which do you think, which bit of gambling would be taxed at the higher rate? Do you think it'd be Wall Street, or do you think it'd be the lottery? Well, you know what it is. It's what affects you and me. Because we're the ones who are dumb enough to buy lottery tickets. I'm going to take a quick break. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you can go get the podcast or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Quick break. Back with Hour 3.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 600 workers at five nursing home facilities in Connecticut who have been on strike more than 5 months have been reinstated by a federal judge in Hartford. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
All right, guys, so we're going to have people from the other picket lines come in here throughout the day, okay? We're having a lot of politicians, a lot of community people tonight, okay? This is the time to show this company that we won, right?
That was Jesse Martin, an organizer with the New England Healthcare Employees Union, District 1199, speaking to workers at Healthbridge's West River Nursing Home in Milford last Thursday morning. The company had locked out the workers at that site exactly 1 year before, and a planned candlelight vigil to mark the anniversary turned into a celebration instead. After 113 days, a judge ordered the company to end the lockout, and 2 months later, in mid-June, Healthbridge imposed its own contract. The company's offer froze pensions and raised workers' health insurance premiums by at least $6,000 more per year for family coverage. It also took back 6 paid sick days and a week's vacation for many employees. So workers at all 5 facilities walked out. On December 12th, federal judge Robert Schettini ruled that the company had refused to bargain in good faith and had imposed the cuts unilaterally. He ordered all the workers reinstated by Monday, December 17th. Noreen Gates, a 20-year employee who's the central supply coordinator, said the company underestimated the workers' determination.
When they locked us out last December, I think that they felt that they locked just West River out and not the others because they felt that we were the weakest link in the union. And it's kind of backfired in a way because this line is stronger than ever now.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Milford, Connecticut.
Clear Channel is turning off the broadcasting antenna at WDTW in Detroit, taking the Progressive Talk AM station dark at the end of December. This follows the end of Progressive Talk at KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, and at KFNQ in Seattle. Tony Truppiano hosts the daily First Shift pro-labor talk show on WDTW in Detroit. He knew after the passage of the anti-union so-called right-to-work legislation in Michigan that it would be harder to continue to rely on labor union sponsors to keep his show thriving. Truppiano is devastated by the decision, but told his listeners he hopes that they carry on their struggle for economic and social justice for working people.
I am heartbroken. I am devastated. I can't thank you enough for everything you have done to fight for the good people of the state of Michigan and in our communities. It is critical to me that no matter if I'm on the air or not, whether I'm leading you or not, that you continue to fight this fight that is so critical to restore some sanity as we move forward.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more visit laborradio.org.
I am 60 years old. I was born in 1951. I went through the civil rights era, and I'm telling you, I'm still here. And if I can stand, you can stand and keep standing.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So yesterday, the National Domestic Workers Alliance released a new report titled Home Economics, the Invisible and Unregulated World of Domestic Work. They examined the state of domestic work here in the U.S., and they surveyed some 2,000 nannies, house cleaners, and caregivers across the nation, 14 cities. They focused on looking at the low pay, looking at the lack of benefits, and looking at the impact on the lives of these working people. I've got Mirla Baldonado, a caregiver and a full-time organizer with the Chicago Coalition of Household Workers and Latino Union on the line to talk about this historic report. Mirla, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad to be able to speak to you again.
So, you know, why is this report historic? Why is this such a valuable tool?
Yeah, because this is the first one that ever happened. And it seems like for me, as an organizer, able to confirm that it's not only 1, 2, 3, but it's, you know, it's a huge percentage of people who are excluded and who are living with poverty wages and being abused at work. So Yeah, it confirms a lot of undervalued work that we are doing.
Well, how is what you're doing, how is being a domestic worker, a home care worker, how is that different from say, other jobs, working maybe in a nursing home or working in a hospital? How is it different?
Yeah, the difference is that you work 24 hours in a household, and then you enter a private space where the rule of, you know, the owner of the house or the client or the family, their whims are, you know, the ones that are being followed. And then there's no contract for most of the time. I mean, I haven't heard of any that has a contract.
Right.
And then there are no benefits. You work for hours, 24-hour work. You're isolated. And then you don't have a recourse if there's a problem. You cannot complain. People are afraid of retaliation. So and you're isolated. And then, you know, you're not being treated well. So it's a very difficult type of work.
And looking at the report that came out with the National Domestic Workers Alliance released yesterday, what were some of the findings? I mean, obviously there's the low pay and the lack of benefits and, the things that go on there. What else did they find?
Yeah. The other thing is that, like, 60%, half of the wages go to housing, and then 30% for the last month before the interview were delayed in paying their rentals and mortgages. And then you have 20% that there were times in previous months when there was no food to eat for these people.
Right. So are there any laws that protect domestic workers? I mean, when I think of a domestic worker, I'm thinking of someone who, maybe taking care of a senior citizen who's trying to stay in their home and have some measure of independent living without being put in a nursing home. I'm thinking of, nannies who are taking care of people's kids. Any rules, any laws, or are there any jobs that I'm missing?
Yeah. We are excluded from the law. The Fair Labor Standard Act. We're not entitled to minimum wage. The ones who are working directly in the home are direct hired by families. We're not entitled to overtime pay. So in my case, I worked as a caregiver for $110 a day. That comes up to $1,760 a month. And then, so that's an average of $4.50 an hour, which is very far from the Chicago, the Illinois.
Yeah, it's less than half of that minimum wage.
Per hour, yeah. So, and then, yeah. So, and I work 96 hours. There is no overtime pay for that. When in a regular work, 40 hours after, you have overtime pay. So it's really very difficult. Like,
yeah.
I have 4 adopted children in the Philippines. I sent over $800. How many will remain? I even have difficulty paying for a $350 room. So, yeah, that's what is actually happening.
So,
and then other findings is that we're working. There are 38% workers who suffered from work-related injuries.
So are they covered by workman's comp? I mean, if you get hurt on the job, if you get hurt as cleaning
no,
the house,
we're
or
not.
Do you get any type of workers' comp or nothing? You're just
no,
what,
no,
you're
we're
just
not
on your
entitled
own?
To co- we're not entitled to workers' compensation.
So you're just
and
on your own.
And we even tend to lose the job. A lot of workers, they lose the job and they get hurt.
Well, that's not right. So what can be done to change this? Are there any movements going on across the country where they're trying to organize these workers? What's going on?
Yeah, we're organizing the workers. California already won in the domestic workers' Bill of Rights. And Massachusetts, Illinois are fighting for it, then California also will refile the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights to correct those. And among the other problems is that there are no paid sick leave, no meal break, and so it's like we don't have 5-hour interrupted sleep. So most of the time the workers work for hours until nighttime. So, yeah. So what we're trying to do is to get together.
Right.
To have a domestic right on the state level. And on the national level, we are working with the Department of Labor so that we will be the companionship exclusion will be removed and that we will become part of the regular labor.
Yeah, explain the exclusion to me. This is the first I've heard of it. What is the exclusion you spoke of?
The exclusion is that we're not entitled to minimum wage and overtime pay in the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Okay.
Because we're working directly in the home, but so the one who works through agencies, they are entitled to it.
If someone works through an agency, if I go through, you know, one of these care agencies that you can get for people to come to your home and help, like with my grandmother, for instance, who needs someone to check in around her every once in a while, you go through an agency. That's covered by the law, but if I hire someone directly, it's not?
However, the catch there is that even if it's covered by the law, the agencies also don't follow the law.
Yeah, no surprise there.
You know,
so tell me about
you have to still fight for it.
Right. So tell me about this Bill of Rights. What would be if you had your perfect Bill of Rights? What would it be? What would you want for these folks who are doing this work?
On the state level, there will be a legislation that will, you know, entitle us to be paid minimum wage, overtime pay. And then usually there would be like, you know, having paid sick leave and sometimes severance pay, you know, like 2 weeks pay before you are dismissed. And then, at least a 2 weeks notice before they let you go or, they remove you from your job and having meal break. And some things like being able to cook your own food also.
Right.
Or when you report work and there's no work, at least they should pay you 4 hours for the trip going there. Things like that.
Just basic dignity and basic respect.
Yeah. Well, the Bill of Rights of California had something about discrimination, you know. That the workers are entitled not to be discriminated.
Or abused or treated poorly. There's got to be some. See, because, you know, I listen to this and I can't imagine, you know, I realize our labor laws are fractured and broken and outdated. But, you know, I listen to this and I can't believe that this kind of stuff goes on in this country.
So it's a legacy of slavery, actually. Because when they signed when the Fair Labor Standard Act came into being, it was, you know, right after slavery. And so most of those who are working are women and people of color. And right now, the extension is we are immigrants. Most of those who are working in this are immigrants.
Right.
So that's the profile. So it's an extension of the slavery, the undervaluing of women's work in the household, domestic work, unpaid or paid.
And I would guess this has been viewed in the past as something that families should be doing for each other, and the people who are maybe doing the care are family members, aunts, you know, wives, whatever. And maybe that's how. So what can we do to help? How do we move this thing forward?
Yeah, the people who understand the issues, and value what these domestic workers are doing and contributing to the economy, and also that we are doing valuable contribution to the caring for the elderly and the younger generation. So if we could, if you could help us speak to power, I mean, when we do this lobbying on the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights,
call the congressman, call.
Help us. Yep. You help us lobby.
Yep.
And also help us explain to the people and change, you know, that care should be, there should be dignity and respect for the workers who are doing the care for America.
Right.
And that they should be given, you know, training. And then it also includes that we're also lobbying for the member of the family who's doing caregiving work should have tax credit. So we're all in this together. We're in this together to solve the care crisis that's happening in America due to the shift in demographics, that there are more and more older people and their caregiving is needed more and more in the coming years. And if we don't change our ways in terms of protecting the rights of the workers, there will be a crisis, a gap in caregiving.
Yep. The website, domesticworkers.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mirla's name. It'll take you right there. Mirla Baldonado, I appreciate your time. I appreciate the work.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for listening and for, you know, respecting the work that makes all work possible.
Yep, we need to respect work no matter what it is. Domesticworkers.org, the website. Again, we've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mirla's name. It'll take you right there. Mirla, thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Homeowners, cold weather is almost upon us. Use the equity in your house to keep warm and toasty all winter long. Save your energy with new windows and keep the outside out and the inside in. Or roll out a new carpet for those holiday guests. Stop sending money out the door and get it on the house. With a home equity line of credit from PSECU. You can borrow up to 80% of your home's value at just a 3.25 annual percentage rate with a PSECU home equity line of credit. Other rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/HELOC.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
After saddling Hostess Brands with nearly $1 billion in debt, engaging in years of gross mismanagement, plunging the sugary snack maker into bankruptcy, and eliminating the middle-class jobs of some 18,000 Americans, shouldn't the owners and top executives at least have to say we're sorry and do some sort of penance? Of course they should. But don't hold your breath waiting for common ethics to flower in Hostess headquarters. After all, this is corporate world, a laissez-faire land where failure at the top is not punished, but magically rewarded. Thus, the maker of Twinkies, Ho-Hos, Ding Dongs, and Devil Dogs has announced that 19 of the executives who made a mess of Hostess are now to be given $1.8 million in bonuses, on top of sweet pay raises they'd already grabbed. The bonuses were described as incentive pay to keep these geniuses on the job as they oversee the firing of all those workers. However, CEO Gregory Rayburn will not get a bonus, but shed no tears for him, since he's currently being paid $125,000 a month to dismantle the corporation.
Also, while Lord Gregory has imposed a company-wide pay cut on management employees, he generously exempted himself from the hit. Talk about a devil dog. But wait, there's more. Not satisfied with killing the jobs of 18,000 workers, Hostess Honchos also looted money that, by contract, was supposed to go into the workers' pension funds. As the company was sinking toward bankruptcy, the ding-dongs in the executive suite, who, remember, were giving themselves pay raises at the time, were secretly diverting worker pension money into corporate operations in a stopgap ploy to keep Hostess afloat and to disguise their incompetence. This is Jim Hightower saying, forget doing penance. These guys ought to be doing 10 to 20 in prison for grand larceny.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anneed the light the way that you
absolutely. Listen to the radio and listen to the Rick Smith Show. Absolutely. Because we're right 100% of the time. You know, I love when Limbaugh and the rest of them say, I'm right 99.7% of the time. And then you go through and you look at all the things that he said. Like, you know what? There are more. I love the book of facts about Limbaugh. It was a couple years ago it was out. He said that, you know, there were more trees here in the U.S. when Columbus founded the country than there are now. And I'm going, you know, just from a rational, logical point of view, that's impossible. But, you know, said it anyway. Oh, boy. Anyway, got an email during the break reminding me that Mitt Romney would have labeled China a currency manipulator. Told me if Mitt were president, he'd take on China, he'd label them. And it's a reference to yesterday's report put out by the Treasury Department, titled Semi-Annual Report to Congress on International Economic and Exchange Rate Policies. They did not call China the currency manipulator that we know they are. Now, they pointed out that, you know, the yuan has appreciated, you know, and it's working, they're trying. I'm a believer we need to take stronger action. Last year, they had a record trade deficit with the Chinese, $295 billion with one country. $295 billion. And, you know, you hear people go, oh, we're borrowing money from the Chinese. Pay for those food stamps. Nobody seems to mind that we're borrowing money from the Chinese to buy products that we used to make here. No, not so much. And you got all these people with this free trade fetish. On both sides of the political aisle, on the Republican and the Democratic side, oh, we're going to have free trade. Let's sell off all our stuff. I'm looking at this latest bit. And you remember, I think it was like two years ago when Glenn Thompson, the Republican representative here in Pennsylvania, said, well, what we need to do is we need to be exporting that natural gas. And a lot of people said, no, can't do that. Crazy, don't do it. Well, now you got a Democratic senator from Louisiana, Mary Landrieu. Said today that, well, you know, we need to expand natural gas exports. And she's a member of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Said, you know, maybe Congress does need to step in and make that clear that is the policy of the United States, and these are the reasons why. She says, I'm a believer in exporting some of our gas. Now, stop and think about this for a second. Natural gas prices fairly low. Businesses are doing pretty well. Getting cheap energy. What do you think making natural gas, the liquefied natural gas, what do you think making that an international commodity will do to the prices? Let me think. Hold on. What if we were to make it an international commodity, why would America's Natural Gas Alliance, you know, these gas producers, you know, their front group, why would they be so in favor of exporting natural gas? Why would they be, why would they want the gas to be a global product? Oh, yeah! So they could raise the price. See, I love that. Love that mentality. You know, they sold us on, hey, let's frack, let's drill, baby, drill, because it's going to make us energy independent. It's good for us. And a lot of people bought into it, that the natural gas would stay here, the gas would stay here, and we could be energy independent. I never bought that argument, because I knew eventually they would con us into making it a global commodity and selling it globally, which means that we're going to have all of the negative environmental impacts without the energy independence that we were promised with. So we're going to get stuck again with everything the American taxpayer, the American citizen gets stuck with, the externalities, the pollution, the bad air, the water, you know, all of that stuff, the ground that's polluted. We're stuck with that. And the handfuls, you know, the coal barons, the gas barons, the oil barons, they are the ones who do well. But, Rick, it would create jobs. And it would create some. I agree. But at what cost? I had somebody recently tell me that, you know, it would be a good thing because we need to create jobs. And we drill, we do a whole bunch of drilling, and then we do cleanup. And that'd be two sets of jobs. The jobs to drill and cause the mess, and the jobs to clean up. It's a win-win situation. I said, well, what about all the people who get sick? What about the water that I'm not going to be able to drink? And he actually told me, if you had well water, you wouldn't have to worry about that. I got a well, he said. I don't have to worry about it. I go, you do realize that it's all coming from the same underground system, don't you? You do understand when they drill, baby drill, and they pollute the ground, it does get into the water. You get that, right? And there was part of me that, as I looked at him, and you saw the marbles rolling around, that he didn't get it. He thought, you know, I've got this hole in the ground, and that's where my water sits, and I don't have to worry about it. Scares me. Just scares me. And there's a lot of support for putting the gas on the international market. Republican Senator from Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, on the Energy Committee. Strong voice for exporting natural gas. Got to get that out there. Got to be a boost to the economy. And it's not going to hurt our domestic industries whatsoever. Oh, wow. What can you do? Representative Tom Rooney, Republican from Florida, put a recent op-ed in the newspaper down there in Florida. And you, at the Daily Caller, you got to love the op-ed where he supports tariffs for the sugar industry. And heavy tariffs for the sugar industry. Protects the industry. He writes, sugar producers from my home state of Florida and across the country have some of the lowest production costs in the world. However, they cannot compete with the heavy hand of the Brazilian government or with Brazil's sugar labor force that, in some cases, makes just 50 cents an hour. Let me read that again because I think it's important. What he's saying is the Florida sugar producers, who he claims have some of the lowest production costs in the world, they can't compete. They can't compete because of the Brazilian government, but they can't compete because the workforce in Brazil makes 50 cents an hour. Now, understand, Mr. Rooney, the Republican from Florida, is a big supporter of expanding free trade. What more? More free trade, except for sugar, of course. Because on the sugar thing, he gets it. He gets the fact that cheap labor is killing their industry. He gets it. He writes, after European governments allowed Europe's sugar industry to go out of business, 120,000 Europeans lost their jobs, sugar supplies fell, and prices rose. So he's arguing that the Brazilian sugar producers would destroy jobs in this country because they're selling cheaper sugar and would be more expensive at the same time. I don't understand. Now, what I do understand, and I agree with, if you put us into these free trade arguments where we can't compete with the labor costs, like the Chinese $295 billion trade deficit last year, and the advantage that they have is cheap, exploitable labor with environmental laws that are basically non-existent. If we had rules, if we had, tariffs like we do on sugar from Brazil, we could encourage a domestic industry, correct? So I'm with Tom Rooney on this. I'm with, let's protect our industries. Oh, but Rick, you're being a protectionist. Damn right I am. I don't know anybody who walks out of their house, leaves the door wide open with a big sign, comes, take me. Now, I don't have a moat around my house, but I do lock the door when I leave most of the time. But this free trade fetish, at some point, we've got to wake up from this nightmare and come to some simple realities. Trade is good when done right. Trade benefits both countries, I believe. But race to the bottom, cutthroat, laissez-faire free trade, not so much. Which is kind of what he's arguing against. He points out that in Europe, since they've lost 120,000 jobs because, of course, the supplies fell and prices rose, there were reports of rationing in Germany. And he says, America hasn't seen rationing since World War II, the last time we depended on foreign sugar producers. Which leads me to an interesting thought. We should not be relying on foreign producers, not just for sugar, but for anything. I've always been a supporter of being independent. And this is where I think across the political spectrum, not the political hacks in D.C. and not the people who are on the special interest payrolls, but average, everyday working people, the ham and eggers, the lunch bucket crowd. This is where we get it. We shouldn't be dependent. And if I were Obama, I would look to the Department of Defense, and I would look for that report that said there are thousands of things that our military-industrial complex cannot make here because we've allowed it to be shipped overseas. To me, that seems to be a good place to start the job hunt. Because you go back and bring this all full circle. You want to solve the fiscal mirage. You want to solve our deficit problems. You want to solve our debt problems. J-O-B. Create jobs. Put people to work. Even if that means government is the employer of last resort. Even if that means we start, the CCC or the WPA or something along those lines where we get people earning a paycheck, paying taxes, supporting the local communities. That's how we turn all of our problems around. Not focusing on austerity, not focusing on how much we can steal from the poor, but getting people back to work. Seems simple to me. And I think it is fairly simple. If only we had the political will, the courage, and the spine. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this with Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone. And after out of road. Riders on the storm.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Holiday.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 902-2561.
Earth, sky.
You often hear the mass of our Milky Way galaxy is equal to several hundred billion stars, like our sun.
Now, some astronomers are suggesting more mass for our Milky Way, 1.6 trillion suns.
The new estimate is based on the first ever measurement of the proper motion, or sideways motion, of a small satellite galaxy to our Milky Way. Our galaxy has some 24 known satellite galaxies. This one is called LEO 1.
If you knew the size of the orbits of these Milky Way satellites, their speeds in orbit, and how long they take to orbit our galaxy, you could use the laws of physics to calculate the amount of mass in the Milky Way. But our human lifespans are short in contrast to the lifespans and motions of the galaxies, so these numbers are hard to come by.
Astronomers used the Hubble Space Telescope to compare LEO 1's position in 2006 and 2011 with more than 100 background galaxies to obtain the first measurement of its proper motion. Then they used that number to estimate that LEO 1 orbits at 200 kilometers per second, nearly as fast as our Sun.
But LEO 1 is much farther away than our Sun from the galaxy's center, and that means the Milky Way must be much more massive than previously believed. The new mass estimate is 1.6 trillion solar masses. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Milky Way mass. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So 34 days and counting till the end of the world. Civilization, as we know, ceasing to exist if they can't come up with a grand deal. And it appears more people are maybe possibly considering, raising revenue? Just a thought. Let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. I've got Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, what's going on?
Well, it is 2012, and the end of the world. Maybe, at least, maybe over the cliff end of the world. I don't know. The president's going to start hopping around America on Friday, starting with Philadelphia, to garner some support. I don't think he's going to make a lot of outrageous statements. I really don't think so, because at the end of the day, this deal's going to be cut in Washington. Today the president said, well, Republicans are going to have to give on, the tax for the rich and the Democrats on spending. He didn't say cuts or Medicare or Social Security, but he said on spending.
Right.
I think he's setting the stage for maybe the word reform versus cuts on entitlements might be coming out possibly. Boehner, is having some footwork done by some lieutenants, I would call it. Some of the Republicans are saying, look, if we get 98% of what we want and the other 2%, you know, quote, super rich, we're not violating Grover Norquist's, you know, stranglehold on these pledges that they make of not raising taxes to this, you know, to Grover Norquist. And so you can set this to the stage set, but Boehner has to walk in his conference and say, the president is giving me this. And that's the bottom line of how these things work. Rick, to, you know, just to project on it, I don't think at the end of the day they're going to get everything, any of them, that they want. They're going to have to do a bit in peace and kick the can down a few months for details.
Right. Well, it's like any negotiation. You never walk away from the table with everything you wanted, and you're going to leave some stuff there. I understand that. But for me, it's been, you know, the first, you know, I don't want the first club out of the bag being going, okay, we're going to raise the retirement age. Okay, we're going to slow down the rate of growth for Social Security. The first club out of the bag for me should be the common sense one, which I think everybody agrees. You know, leave the rates for 98% of us, and then, you know, down the road, talk about if we can afford to continue to those handouts for the top 2%.
And you make a good point about they can't write all of this as far as reform or change into the law right now. You've got to bring groups in. You've got to bring people into that process of retirement ages. You know, they did that once before with a commission that took a good amount of time. So it's not something that if everybody thinks it's going to happen in 2 weeks, you know, and it's not going to happen. They'll avert some disasters, don't get me wrong, payroll tax, et cetera, some things that could wreak havoc, but it's going to take a while for this one.
As somebody who's been in these battles in the past, you as a congressman, you've seen a lot of this stuff go on. The end of the world is not coming January 1st, as we're led to believe, is it?
Well, that's correct. And look, by the way, this is self-inflicted. This is like, you know, we aim two guns at ourselves, and then you and I say, gee, you know, Rick, who's pulling those triggers? I mean, they created this thing.
Yep.
They created it. They can uncreate it, or they can move it. But they act like it was, like, fell out of the sky and came down on the Congress. They created this whole scenario.
Which is why I've been calling it the fiscal mirage, because it is exactly that. This is something that they created, quite easily can be done away with.
Correct.
And what frustrates me is the mainstream corporate-controlled media is pushing it as it's the end of civilization. This could be the end of the world.
Well, sure, they're playing into the whole drama of things, and it's a self-inflicted drama. I look at the comments of some of the members up there, and they really act as if, I don't know, the constituents voted this in on them or something. I mean, this is something they did. And they can, you know, it was supposed to be done if they couldn't make a decision. Okay, if they can't make a decision, then they live with it, which means they're going to have to make a decision.
Right. Well, they decide by not deciding. I mean,
by not deciding, correct.
It's a pretty simple thing. And I think right. The president going out and taking the case as he did during the election, I don't think he's going to go too far off the campaign that he ran on, saying, look, you know, keep it for the 98%. Sorry, we can't afford those top 2% anymore. And look, study after study has shown, even if we took those back, not going to hurt the economy a bit.
Well, the Republicans are weary right now. They, you know, Romney's campaign became his whole top 2%.
Right.
It really did.
Yep.
It became the whole ball of wax, which was ridiculous from his end to get into that trap. And that's what the whole campaign became.
Yeah.
And even if, you know, even if they salvage the top 2%, it doesn't, from their point of view, it doesn't change the economy. So he lost that whole message. And now they're paying the price for it.
Yeah, and I understand that Obama and Romney are going to sit down and have lunch. Is this you know, Obama reaching out and saying, hey, you can be a part of this solution, or is this just a, hey, we're going to be nice kind of thing? Because I got to be honest, if I were Obama, I don't see where Romney can help me.
Well, Obama started this. This was his initiative, which shocked me, but it was his initiative. I don't remember this being done this quick by anybody. You know, in this manner. So I don't know what the motive is, but maybe just to have some civility is probably what I think. I mean, you can't offer Romney a job of any type.
Right.
Although there's speculation on the Hill that maybe the president will say, hey, have you got a couple people in mind? But I don't think so. I think it's just a civility action, and the president's trying to show that he's reaching out. This will make great Saturday Night Live fodder, you know.
Oh, of course it will. Because I'd love to be a fly on the wall, because part of me goes, it's just a gloat.
Right.
I mean, because I think I would. Never. I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Yes, I would.
Right.
But, you know, hey, at the end of it, I'd still want to be in the fly on the wall to see where those conversations go.
Okay, exactly. It would be very, very interesting, I think, huh?
Yeah, it is what it is. I guess Geithner's going to the Hill?
Yes, he's going. I don't call this a full court press. I call this, you know, creative meetings, and I don't think it'll hurt them. And Geithner's going to the Hill. He's going to be talking to, you know, Hill leaders. That'll be both sides of the aisle, and which he has to cover. I think it's a good move on their part. It's going to come out better than Susan Rice's visits, I can predict to you. So I think Geithner is making the right move.
Yeah, what's the deal with this thing with Susan Rice? I mean, is it that big of a deal? I mean, you know, I remember the whole Condoleezza Rice thing. I go back to the, you know, kind of missed that whole 9/11 thing, kind of missed all that, but still not the kind of vitriol, not the finger pointing at her that we're seeing for this one.
There's two things, I think, three things going on here. John McCain baited her on Sunday. He did. He baited her. He went on the Sunday talk circuit. Oh, well, you know, I'm open-minded, blah, blah. She comes Monday. She comes to the Hill. And, of course, McCain and Lindsey Graham, the senator from the Carolinas, come out swinging after the meeting. Well, it's worse than we thought. McCain's trying to play into a legacy now, you know, and he's got everything to say about everything of the Mideast. So, two, a Benghazi scapegoat, frankly. Look, Colin Powell went to the UN and said that we have these little things called weapons of mass destruction, as he was fed intelligence.
With cartoons.
Yeah. Now, let's say that, you know, let's say that the intelligence is bad. Let's say it was fabricated, or let's say it was a mistake by the Obama administration, one of the three, okay? Let's say.
Okay.
From the intelligence agencies, because we're not the best of any president of intelligence, right?
Absolutely.
That doesn't mean that she, Susan Rice, stood there and made this all up. So she made a statement. She made a statement as Ambassador UN based on something that was told to her. But all of a sudden she has become sort of the head of the NSA or CIA for some reason. And I think she's the, you know, dartboard.
Yeah.
Right now.
And for me, it's all about making Obama look bad and just poking your finger in his eye. That's, to me, that's what all this is about.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, there's now, the one other thing I was going to say, I said there's three things. I have a gut. There are some senators out there, maybe some of the Democratic side's been a little bit quiet, out there saying, hey, you know, John Kerry, now, he would be the choice for Secretary of State.
No.
We would sail him through. So it's going to be, you know, the president deciding whether he wants to set her up for the, you know, the confirmation. But also, if she doesn't have some key Republicans, she will fail in the vote.
Right. And, you know, I can see why they would want John Kerry to take that position, because, well, Scott Brown might need a job.
Yes, and of course, you know, the temptation there is Kerry will sail through the nomination process. That's temptation for the White House.
Yeah. We'll see how that goes. What do you think is going to happen in January with this filibuster rule? There's been a bunch of talk about potentially changing that. And I got to be honest, I'm in favor of going back to the good old days where if you wanted the filibuster, you took your cot and you took your water jug and your empty jug and you were there the whole time.
Mm-hmm. You know, Harry Reid's talking about, he's not really talking about doing away with the filibuster. He's talking about altering it. And look, let's be real about this thing. When the Republicans are in control, they want to alter the filibuster. When the Democrats are in control, they want to alter the filibuster. When the Republicans are in control, they don't want to. You know, this has been historic. This thing was created by the minority, which were Republicans years ago. It's a goofy, kind of crazy thing. You don't need a simple majority, but yeah, if you want to actually have filibusters, you should have to go there and camp out.
Yeah, I'm not against the idea of a filibuster. If you're going to go and you're going to make your case and you should be mm-hmm. there holding the floor on topic, I don't want you reading Moby Dick or War and Peace, but we should have to debate this stuff until nobody's got any breath left in them. And if, you know, the minority party wants to keep going, at least the voters will then see exactly who's doing this.
And like I said, whoever controls the Senate always wants to kind of change it, and then if they go in minority, they don't. This is like historic every year. You can predict this one.
Is it going to happen?
They might make some alterations for it, but they're not going to do away with the filibuster.
Yeah, I mean, because at some point, you know, when you've got 55 votes, as they're going to have, they're going to have 55 in the Democratic caucus. Something's got to get done. I mean, I saw a statistic in the last year was like 385 filibusters. I didn't get to see all of those.
I mean, if they've got the votes, they can, you know, surely do it. But it's just a question of will, you know, some of the majority say, oh, no, or some of the Republicans will get to them for, you know, other reasons.
Yeah. Interesting.
Stranger things have happened.
Yeah, stranger things. What's going on in the Middle East? What's going on with Palestine?
Oh, just everything. Well, the Palestinians, this is going to be a very historic vote tomorrow. They're going to win big. Only Canada, Germany, and America, and a couple of little, one country, I don't even know what it is, Marshall something. There's only going to be six people voting against it, six countries. It's going to win big. They won't become a full-fledged member, but sort of a partial membership and observer status, and they will win at the UN tomorrow. This is not good for Israel. Israel's downplaying it now. You know, it's not really that important, but this is a definite slap towards Israel.
Yeah, and at us as well.
Yes, and the United States, and again, only Canada and Germany went with this, and Germany's an iffy one right now.
Wow, interesting. Well, we'll see where that goes. Bob, it's always great talking
with you.
I appreciate the
time.
All
right, thanks.
Our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
And politicians, they own their greed and corruption are very well known. On a consumer code of silence is what they defend. We know it, so let's don't pretend. You and me know it, so let's don't
provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Enjoy your holiday.
Earth, sky.
You often hear the mass of our Milky Way galaxy is equal to several hundred billion stars, like our sun.
Now, some astronomers are suggesting more mass for our Milky Way, 1.6 trillion suns.
The new estimate is based on the first ever measurement of the proper motion, or sideways motion, of a small satellite galaxy to our Milky Way. Our galaxy has some two dozen known satellite galaxies. This one is called LEO 1.
If you knew the size of the orbits of these Milky Way satellites, their speeds in orbit, and how long they take to orbit our galaxy, you could use the laws of physics to calculate the amount of mass in the Milky Way. But our human lifespans are short in contrast to the lifespans and motions of the galaxies. So these numbers are hard to come by.
Astronomers use the Hubble Space Telescope to compare LEO 1's position in 2006 and 2011 with more than 100 background galaxies to obtain the first measurement of its proper motion. Then they use that number to estimate that LEO 1 orbits at 200 kilometers per second, nearly as fast as our sun.
But LEO 1 is much farther away than our sun from the galaxy's center. And that means the Milky Way must be much more massive than previously believed. The new mass estimate is 1.6 trillion solar masses. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Milky Way mass. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
United we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I gotta listen to man, spinning on the palm of my hand. I'm almost as if you are the right man. Feeling an end about to wanna be somebody. See somebody, try to free somebody. Gotta listen to man, spinning on the palm of my hand. I'm almost as if you are the right man. Feeling an end about.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on the smartphone. Always can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something I said got your attention, made you think, made you angry. I'd love to hear it, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Interesting piece by Stephen Greenhouse today, pointing out that in New York City, there's a group of religious leaders, of civic community leaders, labor leaders, saying, you know what, we need to be looking at these fast food restaurants. We need to get these workers a little bit of dignity. And the campaign, Fast Food Forward, they've hired about 40 organizers in recent months to go after, you know, McDonald's, the Wendy's, the Domino's, the Taco Bell's, all of these fast food restaurants across the city of New York. to try and get them to pay a decent wage. And what they're saying is they'd like to see at some point that wage being, you know, somewhere around the neighborhood of $15 an hour. With a little bit of benefits, you know, something. Something that you can actually exist on. You know, I was even thinking about that. I mean, $15 an hour in New York City. How do you exist on that? And the story that he tells is, you know, a lot of the people who are working at these fast food joints now, they're making $8 an hour, part-time, 20, 24 hours a week. How do you exist on 10 grand a year in New York City? Well, you do it like Alan Grayson said the other day about the people who are the associates at Walmart. Like he said, he called Walmart the largest recipient of public aid in the country because the workers, they get the earned income tax credit that taxpayers pay for. The workers get Medicaid that the taxpayers pay for. They get unemployment that in most states taxpayers pay for. Here in Pennsylvania, the workers pay a good portion of it as well. Other things like public assistance, food stamps, housing vouchers, LIHEAP, all of these things that are meant to help the poor are going to people who have jobs. And, you know, you heard a lot during this last presidential election about, you know, those 47% of people, those people who don't pay federal income tax. Those are working people. Those are folks who, along with the folks who are on Social Security, the retired people, these are people who are working at these fast food joints, at the Walmarts, at the big box retailers making pathetic wages. And I go back to, you know, the minimum wage should not be the minimum that you can get away with. It should be a little bit higher than that, something maybe you can afford to live on. Maybe just a thought. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. I don't know that I hold much hope. I'm hoping. And we're going to talk to some folks here in the coming days about this campaign and, you know, check the viability and then, you know, how this is going to work. But, you know, and I think the guy in the article that Greenhouse quoted from, I think it was from Domino's, where he had said that, you know, look, they've tried to organize pizza drivers in the past, and it's got such a high turnover that, you know, people don't join because, you know, they're gone. It's an interesting thought. But, you know, and it takes me back, you know, when I was doing some organizing years ago, where you'd go to people and say, well, I'm only going to be here a short time. And I go, well, why don't you make things better now? So the guy behind you doesn't have to get the shaft too. Now, understand, these big companies, you know, the Papa John's of the world who won't, you know, I'm not going to raise my pizza, I'm going to lower hours so we don't have to abide by Obamacare. They're going to fight this tooth and nail. Because, just like Walmart does, if you get one of these stores unionized, you get a handful of them in New York City, the ramification elsewhere is enormous. And I know people are going to say, well, you know, that means you're going to have to raise the price of their hamburger. And you know what? I'm okay raising the price of the hamburger a nickel so that these workers don't have to get health care from the state, don't have to get food stamps, don't have to get heating assistance. And you know what? I don't have to pay the tax on that. So, you know, it could actually be a zero-sum game where it costs us nothing, but the workers have a little dignity and respect where they don't have to go through and spend the time applying for these programs for food stamps or heating assistance or housing vouchers. Just a thought. Just think. Dignity and respect. Reward for work. Wow. I'm turning into a conservative, or at least what they say they believe. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you get it. Stitcher, get it on your smartphone, take the program on the go. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime. Thank you.